Oh, gosh. There are people who can remember when they were 18 months old. I guess I'm always amazed. I just don't believe that's possible. Actually, my first memories were a combination of piano lessons, which I started when I was 7. And around that time, I was initiated. I was became a choir boy in the Anglican Church in Scotland, which is called Episcopalian. And therefore, music played a very, very big part in all of the services. And that's where I started as a boy treble. And then eventually became a tenor as my voice broke.
When did the lightning bolt strike you that conducting might be something to pursue?
I wouldn't say it was a lightning bolt, Sarah. What I would say is that witnessing my father at the helm of the choir and his ability to make out of this very, let's say, the heterogeneity, or just the fact there were so many different voices, making something homogenous, bringing it. My father's favorite word was always unanimity. A unanimous tone. His bar was very high. So it was experiencing my father and the art of conducting, the art of leadership, the authority needed, but the art of persuasion, the respect shown. Over those years, I began to think, wow, that's something I would love to be able to do and see if I can do that as well as my father. And of course, he was steeped in the music of the church, but I was now, at school, far more interested in orchestral music. I didn't really have what it took to become a concert pianist. I'm a good pianist, but the thought of locking myself away for hours on end just by myself was extremely antisocial. I liked making music with colleagues, and that's where my first opportunities at school, I was 14, I was given a chance to lead some of my school friends in a charity concert. Gilbert and Sullivan, some Haydn, I had this telescopic pen that I used as a baton, and out of that, actually, an ensemble began, which I was then the conductor of. So, yes, there was no lightning moment, but I do remember when this group of friends became this so-called Caritas Ensemble, and after perhaps 5 or 6 years, it grew to about 75 players from variety of schools. I was at a boys' school. There was no such thing as co-ed in those days. And then we brought in a girls' school, and then I started doing Dvorak and Beethoven and some Wagner. And that's when it was very clear to me, and I feel in that respect I'm very lucky. I knew very early on what I really wanted to do. The question then becomes, how do you do it? How do you get to the professional level?
Should I ask you how you got to the professional level?
Funny you should ask that. There's a great deal of fantastic amateur music in Great Britain, great youth orchestras, but it really is quite challenging to make it, to move from the amateur to the professional. I had a very, I would say, academic training at university in Edinburgh. While I was doing the academia, I'd taken up the French horn, and I had come to love opera through a visit to Scottish opera. I saw my first installment of The Ring Cycle. That was a lightning bolt. That really hit me between the eyes and changed me forever.
Wagner.
And I realized opera was something I wanted to know more about, specifically the music of Richard Wagner, which led then to the music of Anton Bruckner, the music of Gustav Mahler, etc., etc. So I went from Edinburgh to Cambridge and did a postgraduate degree there. And from there I went to London to the Opera Centre and was trained as a so-called repetiteur, which is a coach in an opera company. And when I was 23, I went to Germany and joined one of the big opera companies there and worked my way through from piano playing to accompanying singers to coaching singers to conducting rehearsals and then eventually standing in front of the real thing. The orchestra.
That's a time-honored career path, I think, in Europe especially, where there are so many full-time opera companies, to be the pianist first. Can you make it as a conductor if you're not a pianist?
You can. I mean, I would say that piano is perhaps in terms of being able to sit down and play a score, or one of the skills I learned at university was score reading. In other words, seeing 5 or 6 voices, string quartet, for instance, and reading all 4 parts simultaneously and playing it at the piano in different clefts and this, that, the other. So the piano is, you can create your own orchestra, so to speak. But There are many, many fine conductors who are clarinetists, they're oboists. I was speaking with Simon Rattle this morning, and he's a timpanist, he's a percussionist. And I mean, he's a very good pianist too, but it's not absolutely essential. But I think it's very important to have some training in playing an instrument in which you've actually sat in an orchestra and you get a feel for what it's like to play with other colleagues. How does an orchestra tune? How does it play together? And but certainly, as a pianist, I enjoy, for instance, one of my other hats is, of course, in Berlin at the opera. And I enjoy, if I've worked with a singer with the orchestra and there are certain things we want to discuss, just taking that person into a studio, and just sitting down and playing, and just the two of us, which is easier than if I'm not a pianist and therefore I need somebody to play for me, and all of a sudden two's company, three's a crowd. And so, yeah, it's not a prerequisite, but it's a big help.
As a sidebar, I'd like to hear more about what's involved in score reading, because this seems to me just an impossible human activity. If you're looking at not just a string quartet, but a whole orchestra, maybe there are 20 lines on that page, mm-hmm. and they're in different clefs. Some mm-hmm. of them are in different keys, like the clarinet A isn't the same as a violin A. How do you learn to process that all and turn it into a coherent chord in your head?
Study.
Are there exercises for this kind of thing that build step by step?
I would say that those exercises that I thought at the time, oh my God, goodness, this is so really academic, and the score reading and sitting down and having a Haydn string quartet put in front of you, and then you're supposed to not only sight read it in terms of reading it, but also, as you say, a viola plays in a different clef. It's practice. It really is practice. I wish I could say just add water or just do this or be a genius, perhaps. Those are a lot of lines that you can't read them simultaneously. I mean, you can with a string quartet. There are four voices. You can perhaps do it for six voices. Your eye is constantly scanning up and down, up and down. You're always a little ahead of what you're playing. But when it comes to, well, I mean, for instance, doing La Mer with a very large symphony orchestra, you've just worked very hard on the score and you know what it sounds like. You can read it, you hear it. And your eye moves to what is at that given moment probably the most important line. It can be the first violin, that may move to a clarinet, that may move to a French horn. But it's just always, it's scanning. You're not reading. I mean, you should
know. You're not sight reading.
No, I mean, you should know the piece well enough that your eye is immediately going to the place because you've practiced it. But
do you mark up your score with highlighters or colors?
I used to mark my scores early on, but I don't know. I find that it's a very interesting question here. I found that when I started marking up my scores too much, for instance, I was just conducting the opera Parsifal in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, and I have a score which I bought in 1983, and I went with James Levine to Bayreuth, to the Mecca, the Wagner Mecca. And I assisted him there, and I just assiduously marked every last little thing. Jimmy conducts this in two, in four. He takes time there, and this, that, and the other. And then he changed from year to year, and then I put in my own markings, and then another conductor would be doing it, and I would be assisting them. And after a while, there were so many markings, I found that when I conducted it myself, I was conducting the markings. That is to say, I was not really looking at the music. And therefore, it's an exercise I go through fairly regularly when I do a piece, a Gustav Mahler symphony, for instance. After 2-3 years, I'll order a new score, and there'll be nothing in it. Once again, in order just to see the music and just... and look, I'm only speaking for myself. But I find that if you mark things up too much, you in some ways you inhibit yourself. You're only doing what, oh yes, this is where I speed up, and this is where I go into four, and this is where I go into two.
This is where I wiggle my pinky.
Yes, you know, this is where I have to wipe my glasses because I can't see a darn thing. So yes, that's where I find that I mark things less and less, because things will occur to you quite spontaneously. Often, I'm sure tonight when I'm conducting the Debussy, there'll be a moment where I'll have some new insight into some... It's not that, isn't that brilliant, but something, some connection, some thematic material connection in this great masterpiece will suddenly become apparent. And you can only see that when you're looking.
You must have known Debussy's La Mer for decades now, but a couple of weeks ago you posted a picture of Debussy saying something about the genius of La Mer, and I wondered what it was that had jumped out at you just that day to inspire that.
I was working on La Mer for here, because I, once again, had a new score. Obviously, I'm some weeks out in terms of just reminding myself of the work and studying it again. And it was while I was working on it, and I was doing some research into it, and all of a sudden I saw this picture in color, and I thought it was just, oh my goodness, to have known that man, and just this revolutionary figure in such subtle ways, and to bring the ocean, to bring the swell, to bring the wind, the waves, the fragrance, the salt, all into a concert hall. Amazing. I saw that picture and took the liberty just to basically an homage.
Debussy was almost a sailor. He thought about being a sailor. He loved being on the sea, even in a storm. Mm. Ended up composing. If you couldn't have been a musician, God forbid, what would you have been?
I would have been a pilot. Absolutely.
Not too different from a sailor, actually.
No, in that you're
riding the swells.
Yes, I was going to say you're at the mercy of
a pilot. Do you fly?
I do. I don't fly, but I'd like to. I was just thinking when you asked the question about score reading. Score reading, in terms of having lots and lots of lines in your vision, mm-hmm. it's not unlike when you're flying an aircraft and you have lots of dials and you know your speed, your altitude, your speed of ascent, speed of and I have a simulator, a flight simulator, both in Berlin and in Jackson Hole. And I fly as much as I can. I love it. And I have a very, he was initially a colleague. He was the principal bass player of the Deutsche Oper Orchestra. He was also a pilot. And he flew very well-known conductors between Berlin and Salzburg and Bayreuth. Of course, he flew professionally. Anyway, I got to become very good friends with him. And he is my instructor. And he comes by once a week and it's astonishing what you can with the computer graphics now. You can really, well, you can have equipment at home, which is what many professional pilots have worked on or continue to work on to keep themselves up to snuff. And my father was in the Royal Air Force. He was, I mean, he didn't do much flying. He was really very much involved in the maintenance of. He was in Rhodesia, what is now Zimbabwe. He was there during the war, Second World War. So I think perhaps I got that in those genes, but oh my goodness. I don't think I'm bright enough. I mean, I you know, when you're talking about aerodynamics and all the things you need to know about, of course I'm far too old for that now, but whether I could have done it, I'm not sure. But flying for me is still utterly remarkable. Utterly remarkable. Not just death-defying. It still never wears off an aircraft taking off, you know, whenever I'm flying, which is a great deal.
Often,
I still, of course, I go through all of this in my head now because I know the checklist and I know what's going on in the cockpit, and I love it.
But just to be clear, you've never flown an airplane.
I've co-piloted a plane because in the Tetons, a lot of people have their jets or they have access to smaller aircraft, and so I've gone up a number of times. And actually, one of the things that really was for me that lightning bolt, that moment, was when I was up with my they were then young children, and I was up with a very, very experienced pilot who had this very beautiful, smallish plane, and he flew me. I had to pick up somebody in Sun Valley, so we flew from Jackson Hole to Sun Valley and back, and I sat in the co-pilot seat, and I got a chance to fly the plane a bit. And we landed back in the Tetons, and he went up a week later by himself and had a stroke. a severe stroke, he managed, I mean, he was an astonishing pilot. He managed to land the plane, the aircraft.
While he was flying.
While he was flying. He was in Vietnam, and he really was this remarkable man. But there was an ambulance waiting for him at Jackson Hole Airport, and he's in a wheelchair. And one of the first calls his wife made was to me to say, if that had happened last week and you'd been there with your children. And that was when I realized I have to be able to land a plane. I have to be, and it's not so much taking off, but I have to be able to land a plane. And that was the moment where I thought, okay, I'm going to study this. So I hope it never happens, but it's good on some level to know that I think I could land that plane now.
Conductor and would-be pilot. Well, in our last minute here, I'd like to ask you about next weekend's concert you're leading with the Atlanta Symphony, mostly Beethoven, including Beethoven's Pastorale Symphony. Beethoven loved nature. You love nature. What do you get out of Beethoven's Sixth?
There's two levels at which this music has an impact on me. The one is just the feeling of, these are like folk tunes, a village wedding, or people thankful for the storm has moved through. You have the simplicity of so many of these themes, which do evoke a more rustic kind of life. You have, of course, the babbling brook in the second movement. That's the one level. But the other level is, there's a deeply, for want of a better word, pantheistic element to this music, this love of humanity. While it's a celebration of nature, it's a celebration of being human. It's a celebration of how precious life is. And when you have this moment where the storm breaks in, on quite literally on this merry village wedding, you can obviously understand it or appreciate it as a real storm. And that's a noisy movement, and it's brilliant. But you can also take it as a moment in life that you weren't reckoning with. You know, fate threw so many curved balls at Ludwig van Beethoven, and yet he bounced back. And it's, as I say, it's this, you can understand it on many different levels. A literal level, but a very spiritual level. At the end of that work, you feel a better person. You feel you've been on another journey.